Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's What a Wonderful World. Louis Armstrong, who will be listening to this station, who's still with us, he was born in 1901. What you're about to hear is a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. My guest this hour is Mark Bowden. That name rings a bell to many of you, of course, because of Black Hawk Down, but he's done many, many other things. He writes for many journals. He's a correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. He lives in the Philadelphia area, but he comes here once a week to teach at Loyola College,
right.
Loyola University now, excuse me, not college. And he's back with us today because of his latest work, Guests of the Ayatollah, the first battle in America's war with militant Islam. That has come out and taken the country by storm. And Mark, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark.
And Mark and I were talking before the show began about this book. And what would you use to describe yourself, Mark, as the way you write?
I write nonfiction novels.
Nonfiction novels, which I think was perfect, actually, the way you've written this book and Black Hawk Down as well. But this particular piece, I have two questions to hit this off with about the beginning. The typical question. I mean, you clearly, when you wrote Black Hawk Down, it was something that was still vivid in the imaginations of Americans and the war in Somalia. And so it was almost current when you did that. But you've gone back now to 1979.
Right.
Almost 30 years ago.
Yeah. Why did I do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what was about that? Was it because of the issues with Iran that we're facing? What was it that drove you to this particular piece of our history?
With any writer, I think a lot of things kind of come together that make a particular project gain traction, you know, and at any given moment, there are a number of directions that I can go. And then for whatever reason, you know, I end up going in one. In this case, in working on Black Hawk Down and the next book, Killing Pablo, I met a lot of the men who were part of Delta Force, who went on this rescue mission, the failed rescue mission to Iran. And, you know, they kept saying, you should write a book about that, which I actually did not want to do. But I was a reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer in 1979 when this episode happened. And after that rescue mission failed, I had a really good friend and a great reporter. He's now the managing editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, Bob Rosenthal, who was assigned the task of finding these guys who went on the rescue mission and writing their story. And poor Rosie struggled with this story for months and could get nowhere. These guys would not talk to anybody. And here I was, 15 years later with these actual guys saying, God, we'd love to tell our stories. And so part of me felt like, you know, how could I not do this? I mean, this is just a real opportunity. But this was a mission that never really got off the ground, so to speak. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought in the context of this whole episode, the takeover of the embassy, I've always been fascinated by stories of captivity, of people who are imprisoned or interrogated. It just struck me as a pivotal moment in modern history. I was surprised to see that no popular historian or journalist had ever done a book about the whole episode.
Mm-hmm.
So it just grew on me to the point where I felt like it was something that would build on my strengths, the things that I'd done in the past, and would make a dramatic story and would be important.
The two things that you were just talking about also ran through my head as I was reading this book and going through it again. And one has to do with the juxtaposition of things in this book. And one has to do with the Delta Force, which you write very powerfully about in this book, and tragically. And one has to do with the world of Iran and the United States today. And what you're writing about here really touches on where we are now. I mean, the military in America, the idea of the Delta Force that dealt with Pablo, and as you wrote in Killing Pablo and Pablo Escobar, what happened here in Iran, I mean, it's become almost the center of the world for our armed forces, are these Delta forces. I mean, they are, I think more and more this is going to be unfold as the role they're really playing throughout the world. And also the power of that moment. I mean, the subtitle of your book really is where we are now. I mean, this was like the opening salvo.
Right.
It's like Fort Sumter
in the Civil War
in some way.
And I think that's only come into focus, Mark, in the last 4 or 5 years, particularly since the September 11th attacks. Because I think, you know, looking back on this episode that happened in 1979, it's always been viewed as, I think, sort of a bizarre episode, almost like an aberration.
Mm-hmm.
It took place in the midst of the Cold War, and it just seemed to come out of left field. I mean, suddenly there's this Islamist revolution, and the United States is being called the Great Satan, and it just didn't compute for most Americans. And I don't really think that once the hostages came home, everything settled down, it was seen as something indicative of the future. It would just seem to be sort of a bizarre episode in the past. Now, though, I think we can see that this Islamist fundamentalism, which we're fighting all over the world, our first real confrontation with that was in Tehran. So in that sense, and also for other reasons, in the sense of special operations, military stuff, I mean, this is where it all began.
Now, when the hostages were taken, I mean, you start this book off, I mean, almost the ordinariness of the day, people beginning their lives here and waking up in the embassy and taking care of things and the embassy surrounded. But a couple of things happened on that morning. I wish you kind of just talk about that. I mean, first of all, what was taking place in Tehran at that moment in the embassy with Bruce Langenhoff and talking to the foreign ministry, so Charge d'Affaires, who's running the embassy at the moment, was not there, and the other folks who were there.
Right.
And back in Washington, I was really fascinated by the questions I never even thought about, that Carter actually asked questions. President Carter asked what would happen if we let the Shah in for treatment when he was kicked out of Iran, and would they take over our embassy? I mean, he actually asked those questions, which I never knew.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, our whole dealings with Iran during that period are evidence of just spectacular intelligence failures. I mean, we failed to anticipate that the Shah would be overthrown, that he would flee the country, and then afterwards failed to anticipate the danger of maintaining this 27-acre embassy compound in the heart of what had become a virulently hostile anti-American city. We were still sort of hopefully believing that the United States could reestablish diplomatic ties with whatever new government formed in Iran. And it was wishful thinking because Iran was such an important country to us in that region. It was our bulwark against Soviet expansion, you know, to the south and to the oil fields to the south. And we were actually content to make peace with whatever Islamic regime developed in Iran. But as it turns out, they weren't too content to deal with us.
Take us back to that moment, though. I mean, I think what happened when we talk about the Shah, he's being overthrown, his relationship with America, and what happened at that exact moment. I think there are a lot of people listening to this broadcast who were not alive at that moment. Mm-hmm. Never don't think about the hostage crisis then, because it's ancient history. But just take us back to that moment for a minute.
Well, after the Shah was overthrown,
who'd been backed by the Americans for
30 years, and for 25 years, it was a really unusual revolution that brought together forces from all directions in Iran. I mean, the opposition to the Shah had grown over years and years, and an alliance had formed between sort of unusual partners. You had leftists, you had communists, you had socialists, you had nationalists. And you had the Muslim mosque network, which had built itself up as a real center of opposition to the Shah. So once the Shah was overthrown, these various factions began struggling amongst themselves to determine what kind of government Iran was going to have. The Ayatollah Khomeini returned from Paris after the Shah fled Iran to millions of people dancing and celebrating in the streets his return. But he didn't seize power. He went to the holy city of Qom, and he established a provisional government just to tend things while a constitution was written. And the provisional government was made up of primarily secular politicians, leftists, some of them nationalists, socialists. So what happened in the takeover of the embassy was that the radical religious students, the Islamists, feared that this provisional government was going to climb back in bed with the United States, destroy this vision that they had for the perfect Islamist society, and return the Shah to the country. So that when they took over the American embassy, it was really, you know, this radical Islamist group, part of what had carried out the revolution, asserting itself and trying to prevent what they saw as a betrayal of their cause.
What's fascinating, the people that you describe here, I mean, you do write this like as if it were a novel kind of unfolding over the course of those months when these hostages were held. And the interesting thing is that the hostages that were held who worked at the embassy in Tehran, the CIA operatives who worked there, mm-hmm. spoke no Farsi.
Right.
But three of the other embassy officials who do the little kind of work him out of the Peace Corps, actually, two of them,
right.
spoke fluent Farsi.
Yeah.
And it was just like, it was almost made no sense.
Well, but it does if you understand the culture of those two agencies. And I think that, I hope that that's changed today. But certainly 25 years ago, people who went into the Foreign Service tended to be academics, tended to be people who were in love with foreign cultures, foreign languages. They had, in the instance of the two characters, Michael Matrinko and John Limbert, who were Foreign Service officers there, had originally come to Iran in the Peace Corps. John Limbert had married an Iranian woman, had, you know, taught at an Iranian university. They were
loved
lovers.
Iran. He loved
they
Iran.
Were lovers of Iran.
Right.
The CIA is a military culture. The guys who end up in the CIA often, you know, come out of the military, and they are, you know, they view the world very rigorously through an American lens. And the best of them, you know, become experts in the countries they're in. But in this case, the three CIA officers who were in Tehran had only been there for a combined total of 4 months.
Right.
Spoke no Farsi. It was ridiculous.
But the people you describe, you spend the time on a lot of them, but there's some of them who you really kind of delve into in a much deeper way. And Limbert and, am I going to say his last name right?
Matrinko. Michael Matrinko.
Yeah. Were the two of the Farsi speakers.
Right.
Both came out of the Peace Corps. Both really loved Iran and hated the American relationship with the Shah. Did not like what America's relationship was with Iran and back in the Shah. They were both opposed to it, which is one of the reasons, I think you said, Limbert didn't want to go back to Iran to work until
Iran was its own country, basically.
Right.
Yeah. And we're very excited, both of them, about the revolution, about the prospects for change in that country. They were excited for their Iranian friends and for the potential of the country and excited about the opportunity to reestablish ties with this country on a more equal footing, instead of the United States having a puppet government in Iran, two fully independent governments dealing with each other as equals, and that was exciting to them. And then instead, they found themselves thrown in rooms, tied to chairs, interrogated, accused of being spies, and basically being scapegoats for the very policy that they deplored.
They despised, and that. It was interesting what you just described. We had a woman on here a bunch of months back, several women who've written books, Iranian women, about their world. One was a Jewish woman who came out of that. She was part of these demonstrations and part of that world. It was a really broad-based mm-hmm. kind of movement in the beginning that this actually helped narrow down into its
right.
Islamic
yeah,
power.
I think that there was a real fear of the religious right, which was just one faction in the revolution.
The Iranian religious right we're talking about.
The Iranian religious right, yeah. The
right.
Islamists, you know, that they were afraid that their secular co-revolutionists were going to sell them out. And when they seized the American embassy, it rallied popular support behind this banner of anti-Americanism and really helped leverage the mullahs more fully into power. And the students who took over the embassy held daily press conferences at the American Embassy compound with documents that they found in the files, and they would use these documents to smear their political rivals. So prominent secular politicians would find themselves branded at these student press conferences as traitors, as spies, as collaborators with the Americans, just because their name showed up on Michael Matrinko's Rolodex, you know, mm-hmm. which a lot of Iranian officials' names would. So they did. So it's like McCarthyite tactics, essentially, to run the secular political leadership out of power, and ultimately, you know, help to put the mullahs firmly in control.
Now, you try to make sense of the chaos of the moment in the beginning of all of this, mm-hmm. when they stormed the walls of the embassy and
right.
came in, and people were in different sections of the embassy at that moment. Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing day, and you know, a tremendous amount of confusion as thousands of Iranian students are pouring into the compound over the walls. You know, any American or any foreign embassy in any country, including those in our country, are there as guests of the host government. There's no way that an embassy can protect itself from, you know, a large crowd in any country. The Marines who stood guard at the embassy, their job is basically to hold off an unruly crowd until the local police or the local mm-hmm. militia comes to protect it. In this case, no local police, no local militia showed up to protect the American embassy, and they were taken hostage by all these students. I think that the leadership of the embassy wisely decided not to shoot at any of the protesters because it probably would have triggered a bloodbath.
There was that interesting scene you read about where the Marine was holding them off. They had shot the tear gas off. The Iranian students were coming in. Mm-hmm. The Marines had their shotguns poised, had a shotgun poised. And the head of security,
Golosinski, yeah,
came down. He's screaming, don't shoot. The Iranian students are screaming, don't shoot.
That's right. And wisely, you know, Golosinski realized that they may shoot and kill some of these protesters, but they're going to run out of ammunition. They're going to get overrun. And ultimately, you know, be torn from limb to limb. I mean, you can imagine the furor it would have incited for this relatively small group of Americans to have killed some of these protesters. So the embassy was surrendered without a shot being fired. And yet it was celebrated in Iran as though they had stormed and taken the most formidable fortress imaginable.
The personalities in this thing were also very different. I mean, there were those who kind of stood up very forcefully to the mm-hmm. and stoically
right.
to their captors.
And not all did. I mean, Michael Matrinko is an example of someone who I think...
And he was not a military attaché. He wasn't CIA.
No, he was a foreign service officer. But they just assumed, because he spoke fluent Farsi, and his job, he was a political officer. His job was to try to make friends and try to understand what was going on in a very interesting time in a very interesting country. And he would file reports with the State Department, whose job it is to better understand, you know, these countries. So that was what Michael was doing. And he was really loving his job. As he describes it, being a political scientist during that ongoing revolution was like being a geologist camped on the rim of an active volcano. So for him to be tied to a chair and thrown into a room and deprived of the opportunity to do his work, to be accused of being a spy, which just infuriated him. And so he nursed his anger, really, through the entire 15 months, using his knowledge of Farsi and Persian culture to basically insult and annoy
and ridicule his captors,
aggravate them. And he found himself beaten frequently and really badly treated as a result.
What struck me about the difference between, and then I'm going to turn to the hostage takers.
Right.
What struck me was that people like Roeder, who was the Air Force attaché, who was the military attaché to the embassy, or deputy military attaché.
Right.
And Matrinko, it's almost as if what got them through those months of captivity was their response to it was to stand up and spit in their face.
Right.
The pain they received, the blows they received from their captors, it was almost as if the pain is what kept them alive every day, saying...
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the biggest threat, I think, in those circumstances is to give in to the fear... when there was tremendous fear that they could be executed or that they would never come home. So the biggest fear is to give – I think the biggest danger is to give in to the boredom, to give in to the fear. And so different hostages came up with different strategies for coping with that. And this one, anger, confrontation, was one that a few of the hostages used, none more than Michael Matrinko. John Limbert, who we've discussed a few minutes ago,
right.
was another Foreign Service officer who happened to be one of the other
Farsi speakers.
And his approach was to embrace his guards, embrace the hostage takers, not collaborate with them against his fellow hostages, but show them who he was really. And, you know, his love for their culture, he ended up teaching his guards about their own history, translating Farsi documents into English, helping them with their homework, because a lot of these hostage takers were, in fact, students. And so, you know, his goal was to make himself a person to them so that if it did come down to them executing people, that they would think twice before they shot him.
And then you had other folks. I mean, I've one of the things that really was upsetting to read about him, just because, I mean, people react to these things all very differently. But
Joe Subic, you're probably thinking
Joe Subic and
right.
Rosen both.
Yeah. Well, Joe Subic was a Army sergeant who is blessed, I guess, or cursed with an overabundance of a desire to please people in authority. And when the embassy was taken, he immediately began trying to be helpful to his captors to the extent that, you know, while the top officials at the embassy were not eager for their captors to know what their position was at the embassy or what their job was, Subic was leading right on the first day, leading these hostage takers around, identifying all of his colleagues for them. This is Colonel Chuck Scott. He's the military liaison. This is Colonel Tom Schaefer. He's the defense attaché. These are jobs that guaranteed that these individuals would be more roughly handled, more roughly treated. So he earned the scorn and anger, you know, of his fellow hostages right from the first day.
And then it was Mr. Rosen, who was the press attaché.
Right.
Terrified.
Yes. And, you know, he was, again, he was one of the three or four who spoke fluent Farsi. He began to give in, I think, or to be crippled by his fear, really, of what would happen. And he began having physical symptoms of terrible anxiety and stress, which he would complain about. He suffered. I mean, he physically suffered
yeah.
while he was there. And as a result, they gave him drugs, which he started to take basically for a lot of the time that he was captive. He would zone out, you know, just taking these drugs, much to the chagrin of his roommate, Dave Rader, who really relied on him for conversation and support. And so different people responded in different ways.
Now, the people who took this embassy, I mean, you start the book off with Hashemi and preparing to go to his meeting, and it was the Muslims who took over, the Muslim groups who took over the embassy were actually split inside themselves over what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there were different factions inside those groups, but they were a fascinating group in their own right.
Yeah, they were. And, you know, they had banded together because of their fear of these secular student organizations, most particularly the Tudeh, which was the Communist Party, which was the best organized and funded of the student movements in Tehran. So the Islamic students formed a group that they called Strengthen the Unity, which was an effort to bring together the five campuses, the five big college campuses in Tehran, all the Islamists from those various campuses into a single organization. And that was the group which included Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the current president of Iran, who planned the takeover of the embassy.
But it's also interesting to me that the hostages who, the people who took the hostages, and you describe in the end of your book, when you talk about where the hostages are now and where the hostage takers are now individually, and you're going to see them, that so many of the people who took these hostages are on the outs with the government. They're on the outside of power.
Well, I think you would see it, you know, in the United States today, if you were to talk to a group of student radicals from the 1960s and 70s, and, you know, as they mature in their middle age today, I'm sure not all of them look back on things they said and did as favorably as they don't feel as good about it today. And that's similar there. I mean, you have people like Ibrahim Ezgarzadeh, who's the man who came up with the idea of seizing the embassy, who today feels it was a bad mistake, realizes that the embassy takeover is the event that effectively leveraged the mullahs fully into power and created this theocracy, which he now does not like living in and has become an outspoken critic of. He's been in and out of jail for his criticism of the regime. And I think it was on the 15th or the 20th anniversary of the takeover of the embassy, he actually gave a speech at what they now call the Den of Spies, the old American embassy, denouncing what they had done 20 years earlier. And
they carted them away.
They did. He ended up spending a little time in jail for that.
I wonder very quickly how you recreate some moments. Well, there's one moment that sticks in my head is when they took the hostages out and were acting as if they were going to execute them.
Right.
And you had them all lined up against the wall the way they were lined up. And, and the feelings were going through each person and what they were thinking as they thought they were about to be killed. It was a very chilling, really chilling moment.
Frightening moment.
Frightening for the reader.
Well, I think what you do as a reporter is realize that this is a very powerful and dramatic moment, and I need to try to elicit from all of the people who were there as much detail as I possibly can about what went through their heads, how they felt, what they did. There are times in writing a story, and I try and teach this to my students, where the writer needs to speed up time, and then there are times where you need to slow down time. And
you slowed it down here in some ways.
Yes, this is something that you want to tell that story second by second by second.
Right.
And fortunately, there were enough hostages who went through that ordeal that I'm able to draw on 20 or more separate accounts. It's funny, when I was in Iran, I asked Mohammad Hashemi, who was one of the primary hostage takers, about this. And he said that it was a lie, that none of the hostages were badly treated at all. And I said, how can you say that? You know, I've interviewed 25 years later, 20 to 30 people whose memories are exactly the same, and interviewed them in different times and places, you know, all over the country. And they're all lying? And he says, well, you know, sometimes things happened over which, you know, we had no control. But that was the most that he would say. He wouldn't admit that they'd actually done this.
See, I think people realize how badly treated these hostages were. I mean, how some of them.
Right. And in fact, you know, for this book, some of the hostages, former hostages who told their stories have done so for the first time. And they tend to be the more higher ranking officials at the embassy. For instance, Tom Ahern, who was the CIA station chief, has never spoken before of his captivity until this book. Right. Michael Matrinko, who we've talked about already, one of the most abused of the hostages, has never told his story before. It's never been written. So there's a lot of these people are really coming forward in this book for the first time.
Did you speak to Matrinko in Afghanistan or here?
No, I spoke to him here. On several occasions. And in fact, I was able to find a long interview with Matrinko that was done in 1981 by another journalist that was never used for any publication or anything. So it was interesting to jog his memory by the things that he was saying 25 years ago.
Guess the Ayatollah is a book by Mark Bowden, The First Battle in America's War with Middle Islam. And Guess the Ayatollah is a book, I think, that tells all sides of this story. The interviews he did with those who took the hostages themselves, the story of the Delta Force, the afterword that really kind of focuses on who and where we are now and where they are now. And Mark Bowden, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here again.
Okay, Mark.
Thank you for the book. Thank you so much for the book. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern and Dan History research producer is Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. On our way out of here, Because by the Beatles, recorded on this day in 1969. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.